I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, November 3rd. Well, it might have been a good night for Democrats in New York City and maybe in Boston and a few other places, but it was not one on either side of New York City. Long Island, really bad for Democrats. New Jersey, big question still in play. And when you look at the two states that voted for governor, New Jersey and Virginia, there were only those two. By extension, it was not a good night for Joe Biden and for the Democratic Party as it hopes to keep power in Congress next year. This, of course, can all be overinterpreted. There is so much that will happen between now and then. But for the blue team and national context last night, not good, leaving new questions to be answered. With me now, Elena Schneider, national political correspondent for Politico, and Nancy Solomon, who covers New Jersey for WNYC. Welcome back, both of you. Nancy, I hope you got at least some sleep, especially with the cold you're rocking right now. But yeah. if you were up waiting for a result, you would have pulled an all-nighter. Where do things stand in the New Jersey's governor's race as we speak?
Well, I did get a few hours of sleep, but you can tell from my voice I'm not doing too well. So I got up at 6, and Jack Cittarelli, the Republican, was ahead of Phil Murphy, the incumbent Democrat, by a little less than 1,200 votes. Since then, more votes have been counted. The AP widget is now moving again. It was stalled for many hours. I guess they went to bed. And now it looks like Murphy is up by about 7,000 votes, which would have seemed minuscule last night, but at the moment it seems like a pretty big lead compared to where he was. The mail-in ballots that are going to get counted all week are expected to break his way as well. So things are looking a little better, but I don't think there's any lipstick you can put on this pig. This was a disaster for Democrats, and it had down-ballot effects as well.
In terms of who might win, ultimately, Nate Cohn from The Times tweeted around 1:30 this morning, "There's still no decision in New Jersey where the count is close and the data is murky, but county by county, it's becoming clear that there are still a lot of Democratic-leaning mail ballots left. That might be enough for Murphy," unquote. How much do you agree with that analysis?
Yeah, I agree, and I think that's what we're seeing, is that these mailed-in ballots are coming in. Not just because it's not that the mail arrived, but they were there and they're getting counted. And it's believed that the mail-in ballot, that Democrats prefer mail-in voting more than Republicans. So that's why it's breaking to Murphy.
And before we bring in Elena with the national context of this, I see that Bergen County is trending on Twitter right now. And for those of you who don't know New Jersey's counties, Bergen is right outside Upper Manhattan and the northern suburbs. Cross the George Washington Bridge, you arrive in Bergen County. Trending on Twitter right now with some Republicans calling for an audit, a word they've used before, because Bergen County flipped to blue this morning when it was red last night with 100% of the votes counted, according to the numbers this morning. Now, we should remember that Bergen County went for Joe Biden, by the numbers that I have, 57-41 over Donald Trump. So it wouldn't be surprising that Bergen County goes for Phil Murphy. What's surprising is that it's so close. Whether, you know, Murphy gets a few more votes or Cittarelli gets a few more votes. So talk about Bergen County. We have a lot of listeners there.
Yeah, and it's, it's the Ohio of New Jersey. It's often said that as goes Bergen County, as goes New Jersey, that it's a very large, very suburban county. And, and it looks like Murphy's winning it by a very small margin. I think what we're going to see is a lot of, sorry, Brian.
That's right. You need a minute? We'll give Nancy a minute here. Go ahead.
I think we're going to see Republicans contesting elections up and down the state over the next few weeks.
Elena Schneider from Politico. Joe Biden won Virginia last year by 10 points. Hillary Clinton and Obama both won Virginia too. And Democrats had controlled both houses of the legislature. The Democrat for governor last night lost. What just happened?
Well, what just happened is Joe Biden is very unpopular right now. He's underwater in terms of his support in Virginia and nationally. And we're living in an environment in which national trends can have real steep implications for a state race, for a gubernatorial race. And this is also, you know, if you drill into the messaging here, that's where it plays out too. Terry McAuliffe, who was trying to run for not quite re-election. Virginia, they only allow one term per governor, but you can run again. So he was elected back in 2013 for the first time. And he was trying to run for this position again. And he really tried to tie Glenn Youngkin, this former, private equity chief executive, to Donald Trump. I mean, you couldn't get more than a few seconds at a McAuliffe rally without Trump coming out of his mouth, because the idea or the theory was that they needed to excite and amp the Democratic base. And nothing has excited the Democratic base more than Donald Trump over the last 5 years. But that was not enough in order, clearly, it was not even close to enough to getting Democrats excited or to counteract sort of the natural political weather of an off-year election in which the party in power is trying to hold a seat here. So, you know, Democrats were always going to face a tougher road in Virginia. I just think that they are certainly waking up disappointed that not only was it a tougher road, it was an impossible road. They weren't able to hold on to it. And Glenn Youngkin was able to do this incredibly intricate, difficult sort of footwork around Donald Trump, where he was able to both embrace him as far as he wanted to without bringing him in and basically holding him at arm's length the entire time. I mean, he embraced the endorsement, but beyond that, Trump really was not something that Glenn Youngkin talked about, nor did he want him there in the state to campaign for him. Yeah. And all of those elements, Biden's really sagging approval ratings, Glenn Youngkin really effectively leaning into sort of winning over independents, sort of a perfect storm for Republicans to pull this off in a blue leaning state.
The biggest city in the state, Virginia Beach, considered a real swing district. A lot of Virginia Beach is suburban, actually, even though it's a city. I used to live around there. It went for Trump by 5 points in 2016. Then it went for Biden by 5 points last year. The Republican, Glenn Youngkin, was winning by 9 points last I looked last night. Also around the rural parts of the state, Youngkin did even better than Trump did in heavily pro-Trump counties. So can you break down the Republican side of that?
Absolutely. So Youngkin had to do a number of things in order to win in a state that is still trending blue in presidential year. So it's important to remember this is an off year. The electorate in an off year, so a non-presidential year, tends to be a little older, a little whiter, and that generally does not bode well for Democrats. So for Youngkin to take advantage of sort of the natural, electorate here, he needed to blow it out in rural counties, particularly in southwestern Virginia, with Trump voters, with voters who had come out largely for the first time for Trump. He was able to absolutely blow away expectations in those rural counties. And then he also had to peel away independents and swing voters in suburban counties. And the reason, and he was able to do that, as you mentioned, Virginia Beach, but it was also in places like Loudoun County, which is outside of Washington, D.C., where he only lost it by 10 points, while Donald Trump lost it by 25 in 2020. Another example is Fairfax County, which is just outside of Washington, D.C., the most populous county in the state. And even though it was an easy McAuliffe hold, he was able to improve his numbers there over Donald Trump's again. So he wasn't sort of hemorrhaging in these suburban counties the way that we've seen Republicans and Trump do in 2020. And why this is setting off such panic within the Democratic Party is because they built their victories in 2018. They built their majority in the House, and Joe Biden's path to the White House in 2020 was built on these suburban voters who rejected Donald Trump, built on these outer ring suburbs, places like Orange County, California, Gwinnett County outside of Atlanta, key places outside of Philadelphia and Wisconsin and in Milwaukee. Those are the counties where Democrats were able to build their majority. And if those voters are slipping away the way that they are in Virginia in 2022, that spells a really, really tough road for them moving forward.
But here, I think, is a very important follow-up question to that. Was it mostly turnout? You know, Republicans as the party out of power were motivated to defeat Democrats in this election. Certainly, Democrats, maybe not massively inspired by Biden right now, were maybe more complacent and didn't turn out as much. So I think it's different, especially in terms of what it would forecast for the 2022 congressional elections. If Youngkin actually won independent suburban women who voted Republican in the past but then got turned off by Donald Trump, if they went back to the Republicans, those same voters, some of them, that's one story. If the Republican base turned out, but the new and large Democratic base was just meh and stayed home, that's a different story and a less threatening one for the Democrats. Can you tell yet which it was?
So I think we still have work to do to match who showed up with the voter file. That takes time. That takes enormous amount of time and energy on the part of both parties who are going to be furiously working on this in the next couple of weeks to figure out and piece together that story. But I think that you're right in that the turnout here was historic for an off year. The last record for an off year election was in 2017 when Ralph Northam won by, 2.6 million people showed up. I haven't checked this morning, but I think we are close, if not surpassing, 3 million people who participated this cycle in an off year. And that is an enormous amount of turnout. So I certainly think that you can't ignore the fact that rural voters and Trump voters showed out in a big way for Republicans, that there was an enthusiasm edge that they had. And we're still going to have to spend some time calculating whether these were people who switched parties in these suburban districts or if Democrats stay home. But I think that for him to hold those margins, there had to be at least some ticket flipping from last year for him to be able to pull this off. Given how many people participated. So look, I mean, it's still early. We're still going to need to do a lot of matching to the voter file. That means sort of figuring out exactly who showed up and how they voted. But I think that the early signs still are pretty bleak for Democrats.
And Nancy Solomon, same question for New Jersey, as the Democratic incumbent Phil Murphy sits at a tie right now with Jack Cittarelli, the Republican challenger, who wasn't supposed to be this close. Can you tell yet if there were a lot of Biden-Cittarelli voters or if the Democrats were just meh and stayed home and the Republicans were very motivated?
I think what we're going to find out is that it's both. Just from the look of this, from the counties that came in for Cittarelli that were Biden counties, I think it's the same dynamic you were just discussing, that moderate New Jersey voters, particularly white suburban voters and exurban, the outer ring of the suburbs, I think they came back to the Republican Party. Now that there was not, that Trump was not an issue as far as they were concerned. And Cittarelli did a good job of making a case to them, despite some of his early mistakes, that he is a moderate and not a Trump Republican. So I think that dynamic is going on. And at the same time, you had Murphy leading in every single poll by double digits. And that had to have depressed Democratic turnout and maybe a level of lack of enthusiasm. Maybe, I think it will probably be said many times this week that, about the mistakes that Murphy made during the campaign, not getting out there quite enough and, making his case about what he was doing for middle-class New Jerseyans. You and I have talked about this quite a bit and the whole storyline around property taxes. So I think it really is going to turn out to be both. I think we're going to see not getting the vote out in the Democratic strongholds as much as he did in 2017. And then many independent and moderate New Jerseyans going back to the Republican Party.
And Kylie in Northern Virginia, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kylie.
Good morning. So I'm a New Jersey native, and I now live in Northern Virginia in Loudoun County, actually. So that breakdown of Loudoun County was quite interesting. And I just wanted to get a response to this thought from your guest. So to me, it just seems like, aside from the Stacey Abrams kind of push in Georgia, that Republican strategists, to me, just seem to kind of play to win, right? I'm a registered Democrat, but I don't really want to go up in a dogfight. I feel like Republican strategists really do play to win, and Democratic strategists seem to be trying to be right or kind of uphold these political ideals or these Democratic ideals. But in my heart, it just feels like Democratic candidates win only when Republican candidates lose. And I just wonder if you all can just kind of talk about the difference in strategies. And both of these races are great examples of that, just how Republican and Democratic strategists approach elections differently.
Elena, you want to talk to Kylie?
Yeah, that's a great question. Look, I think that if we're looking at just Virginia and how the different sort of strategies there played out, clearly, Terry McAuliffe thought that linking Glenn Youngkin to Donald Trump was going to be the recipe that would win. And he had some evidence that that might work. In California, we saw Gavin Newsom was sort of struggling with that recall effort. They turned Larry Elder, the Republican who was running against him in there, into sort of an acolyte of Donald Trump, and it turned around for him. And I think that, you know, often political pundits and staffers and strategists can maybe sometimes overlearn or relearn things of the most recent election and try and take the, okay, this worked here, it's got to work, you know, in the next race. And there was certainly an attempt to try and do that. And whether or not that was too backward facing, I think, is a really goes to your point of sort of like, you know, can Democrats only win if Republicans are losing? That's maybe a fair criticism of how Terry McAuliffe approached this, where rather than focusing on what he was going to do for Virginia, which came through in some ways, but he did not really run on his record from 2013 onwards. He did not really focus as much on what he could or would do for education or for dealing with people's pocketbook issues. It was really primarily focused on a nationalized Donald Trump focus. And I think that that sort of backward looking focus is problematic when fundamentally voters, you know, in an ideal world, any candidate wants to be running on a positive, forward looking, hopeful message. And I think that Terry McAuliffe really struggled to figure out a way to do that with the, you know, his sort of like, you know, let's hope that the base turns out. And if we just try and link to Donald Trump, that'll be enough. Clearly, that wasn't enough. And I'm already hearing from Democrats that I'm speaking to that they're recalculating and recasting how they're envisioning what they're going to do in 2020 in terms of how they're going to run around the messaging there, rather, you know, that simply trying to stick Trump to any Republican just does not seem to necessarily work.
Kylie, could I ask you a question as an individual citizen, individual voter in Loudoun County, Virginia? A lot of the coverage that I saw of that race said that the Republican candidate, Glenn Youngkin, really played on white voters' fears of critical race theory as something that may not actually be getting taught in the Loudoun County and other public schools in the state, but that somehow he got them to be afraid of how race, or something that he called critical race theory, is being taught. I call this the white fragility vote. He got a lot of white people to feel like their kids in school are going to be made to feel badly about themselves by a telling of American history that includes a lot of the bad stuff that happened along racial lines. And so he ran on appealing to that fear. And sure enough, the exit polls that I saw from NBC News last night indicated that a quarter of the voters in Virginia said education was their number one issue. And those voters mm-hmm. went for Youngkin by 18 points. So I'm just curious mm-hmm. if you saw, as a Loudoun County resident, that dynamic playing out and how it looked to you.
So I think that's a good question. What I will say is I've paid very little attention, admittedly. I paid very little attention during this election. And the two things that I'm walking away from right now, number one, everything that I did hear was about schools and kind of what your kids are being taught. I mean, that message really did rise to the top. And the second big takeaway for me is I had no idea that Terry McAuliffe was governor before. So that did not come to the top. So I think the juxtaposition of those two points speaks exactly to what you're talking about, because those are that was the presence and the absence of messages that I walked away with. And so not that I was that tuned in, but I definitely heard a lot about schools.
Thank you for your one voter's view, Kylie. Thank you very much. And Elena Schneider from Politico, last question for you. You know, Lawrence O'Donnell on MSNBC last night said there's always a temptation to overinterpret governor's races in terms of federal races for the next year. So how much do you agree?
I agree that that was once the case, but I think that we are living in an environment in which people more often get their news from MSNBC or Fox News than they do from their own local television affiliates. And if that's where you're getting your political news, you're going to have a national lens on your own state and local politics. That's not to say that good candidates, good campaigns can't still win in this environment. I think that's sort of what he's hitting at, this idea that Democrats are absolutely doomed next cycle. And look, I think that there is a very good chance that they are going to face a very difficult, you know, year in which they already had incredibly slim majorities. And so to hold on to those was already going to be very difficult in 2022. I think he's urging people to not overinterpret, as in saying all is lost. So I agree with that, but to the extent that you shouldn't or that it's not relevant, I think is untrue, because we live both in a nationalized environment. And also, ultimately, these are clues for where the national electorate is. And yes, things might and will change over the next year, but I think it shows a trend line, a direction, and it's happening across these two states. The same problems that are happening for Democrats in Virginia are happening for them. And in New Jersey, vice versa, the positive signs for Republicans in Virginia are the same that we see in New Jersey. And so it gets a little harder to dismiss those results when there's some consistency across states and also the sort of more nationalized environment that we're living in.
Elena Schneider, national political reporter for Politico. Nancy Solomon, who covers New Jersey for WNYC and Gothamist. You're both troopers to keep going this late into the morning after following so many results so late into the night. Thank you so much for coming on. Get some sleep.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.